Today's program is brought to you by the Museum of Food and Drink, sparking curiosity about food with exhibits you can eat. For more information, visit mofad.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network, broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Good morning, Heritage Radio listeners. Today on the show, I welcome Ajay Walia. He is the owner of two Indian restaurants located in San Francisco, Saffron and the Michelin-starred Rasa. Rasa became the only Indian restaurant in California to be awarded a Michelin star. It has also received 3 stars from the San Francisco Chronicle. He was born in New Delhi and he moved to the U.S. to pursue an MBA. And he previously worked at J.P. Morgan and Deloitte. Clearly, he's made other decisions that have led him to the life of becoming a restaurant owner. I'm looking forward to hearing about it today. Welcome to the line.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
So I want to begin by talking about New Delhi when you were a young boy. What type of childhood did you have? Did you grow up going out to eat a lot, or was it mostly eating at home with the family? Who did the cooking?
Well, I think it's traditional in every family. I think it was a combination of both eating out a lot, but that was in the later years as you grew up and you had more freedom to venture out. But it's like, you know, prior to that, it was home cooking. Most of it, it's like, you know, with grandma, more from my mom's side, it's like my nana, and then my grandfather, and my mom as well. But it's like my mom was a working mom, so I think it's like I pretty much grew up on grandparents cooking.
Your parents ran a business together? They worked together, right?
They worked together.
So what did they do?
So we had a fabrication unit. We did a lot of exports to all these brands that, you know, mostly people see. One of the popular ones, Gap, we were making all of their clothing line. And if you've heard, the FC UK, which, you know, just sounds the other way around. It's the French Connection UK. That was one of our biggest customers as well.
So you were producing all their clothes, jeans, shirts, everything like that, and then you would ship it to their distribution centers?
To their warehouses. So it's like, so we were exporting and manufacturing at the same time.
So you grew up in a businessy family. A lot of discussions in the house and at the table about business.
There were always discussions, and that kind of, it's funny that it's like it strengthened my resolve to never be in business.
Interesting. Why is that?
Because, you know, it was just a challenge, you know, every day, because it's like, you know, because we had production facilities with people, you know, staying there as well sometimes, and it's like, you know, we had round-the-clock production and things like that. So it's like, so you were constantly working. And so my thing was, it's like, I just want to have a job, 9-to-5 job, go to work, come back home, and you're done. And it's like, and I want to be as far away from the business as I can be. And I moved here to do my MBA, to pursue that. And, you know, after that, it's like I worked corporate, you know, Lord behold.
Lo and behold, here you are,
here
using
I am.
Your business
like,
degree,
you know,
to run a business.
And I am in the crazier business than my parents were.
Were you the type of kid, did they let you run around the factory and explore? Was it fun for your parents to be involved in that as a young kid? Or was it something that you didn't really see that much?
Well, I mean, I was around the business a lot. And it was more so after my grandfather passed away. Mm-hmm. Because it was also where the parents could keep an eye on everybody. So it was not a matter of choice. It's like after school, your father picked you up and it's like, you know, you went to the factory and you hung around and that's
you
it.
You had to sit there until dad was done, right?
Until they were done. Or mom was ready to go home. So mom would leave a bit earlier than dad would, and then dad would follow like a couple of hours later. So
your grandpa was really important to you.
He was.
You spent a lot of time with him.
I did.
Can you speak a little bit about your grandfather and how did he impact your life up until when you were 12 years old?
Well, I think it's like it was mostly a life of privilege, being the only son, you know, at least in our part of the countries. You know, back then, it was always that you needed a son, somebody to carry on your, you know, family lineage and things like that. We don't think of it that way anymore, but it's like it definitely was true back in the days. And I have 3 sisters, so I always had a very preferential treatment. That's what I remember the most about
it. The prince.
Yes, you can say that. So I always had access to everything above and beyond what my siblings had. And I could, that also meant that I could get away with a lot of things as well.
Mm-hmm.
So
you complete your undergraduate degree.
I did.
There.
Yes.
And I then did. What... how did you decide to come and study in the United States? Was it, did you want to do it? Was that your parents urging? How did you end up leaving what seems like a sort of a wonderful setup to sort of continue working in the family business?
Right.
You got an MBA, but decided to leave.
True. So, well, the decision to come here was completely my own. The decision to pursue an MBA as well was my own as well. At the time, I think it's like, when I look back, it's like, I don't even think it's like I ever knew what MBA stood for when I started to think that I would do an MBA. Mm-hmm. And I still think to this day and age that it's like when I did it, it was too early on. If I could do it all over again, probably I'd do it now. Because there is a real world experience mm-hmm. behind versus it's like, you know, just textbook at the time. And
so... when you move to America, where do you move to? And was it a culture shock? Had you been before? Like, how did you feel coming here really far away from your family? Was it a feeling of excitement or the opposite?
I think it's a combination of both. And I had traveled many times prior to that for business. You know, helping and my dad, and then it's like I wanted to come here anyway, so that was a, you know, great opportunity to come in and see. I ended up in Chicago, and you know, both my wife and I, we both moved here, and you know, we lived here. So it was exciting at first, but you know, more depressing later. And I think that was more it was more real around the holidays. Because you were alone, you didn't know anyone. There was no family to go back to, or no one to go to. So there was a lot of that void in between. Which you know, eventually, as you stay and then you become with friends with other people, you know, that kind of goes away.
So I am curious about when you're living in Chicago. You do have a friend who is a chef or is a restaurant owner. I saw a little something about this.
Yes.
And so you helped him in some capacity, right?
Can
you tell the listeners exactly, like, was this your first foray into the restaurant world? How did you end up getting sort of roped into this, helping a chef friend type
right.
of scenario?
Well, it's like, you know, prior to meeting him, my foray was always from the other end, which was from the consumer end of it. And it's like I ate a lot. And, you know, eating out, I was privileged enough to, it's like, you know, eat at the best restaurants, best hole-in-the-wall places. So we knew in the city the digs of, you know, where we go for a particular item. And it's like, you know, so I have a lot of memories of that. Now, that's changed now because it's like, you know, there's an influx of all kinds of cuisine. But there was before, while I was growing up, it was only Indian cuisine. And there's a huge variety there. And when I came here, I was introduced to this guy, who I consider to be my mentor, although it's like he doesn't feel that way, it was just a very natural feeling. It's like because I very quickly connected with him. You know, as a friend, I connected with him. As somebody that came from the same area, you know, where I grew up, it's like, you know, there was an instant connection there that way. And, you know, and I saw it's like, you know, well, in this profession, most of the people are not educated. And he's not either. And that was because it's like he wasn't privileged as much as I was. And his father was a executive chef here at Dawat Restaurant in New York, which is Mother Jaffrey's restaurant. And so he grew up in that family. And he had a restaurant of his own, Great Resolve, and I told him, it's like, I'll help you at the front of the house because that's all I know. And, you know, I can write your checks, I can do your documentation and do other stuff, and that's kind of where it started. So it's like, you know, as you get into the restaurant, it's like I had a day job, and evenings I was free. We didn't have kids. And, you know, both me and my wife, it's like we're pretty passionate about at least Indian food. And so it became natural. It's like, you know, I hung around him, and then it's like before I knew it, I was sucked.
So you sort of started off as his de facto bookkeeper in a way,
or
you
yes, were, you absolutely.
Were, so, and did that mean, did you have interaction with customers? Were you in the restaurant at night, or were you more like in an office?
No, I was always in the restaurant in itself. It's like, you know, working front of the house. Mm-hmm. And it was more front of the house was it's like, you know, bookkeeping, and then it's like, you know, making checks. Back in the day, we didn't have the point of sale systems.
Right.
So we were the old fashioned way the KOT tickets came in, and it's like, they were nights. It's like, as a busy restaurant, small 40 seat restaurant, but it's like, you know, with a good turnover. And there were nights where I never looked up the entire night, because mm-hmm. it's like, all I heard was, well, we need check for table 3, we need check for table 6, you know, can you add this to that check, and then here we go all over again. And my biggest thing was, it's like, I hated when the handwritten checks had, oh, cancel this and then add that to it. So I would start all over again and then make a new check, because it's like, when I wanted that to be presented to the guest, I didn't want, like, you know, a whole bunch of scribbling on it,
mm-hmm.
canceling, adding, and things right. like that. And then, of course, at the end, it's like somebody adds after the check is all done. Now I got to do it all over again.
So did you become, at that point, did you become invested in that restaurant? Did you take on a partnership level role in that spot?
So I was never financially invested.
Okay.
I was always emotionally very invested into the restaurant. I called it my own. Until date, it's like I feel the exact same way. It's
and
not
what was
different.
It called?
It's called India House.
Okay.
In Chicago.
Still around?
It's still around.
Awesome.
And they do a remarkable job. It's, you know, they, at one time, it's like, you know, we're the biggest banquet in the country, Indian, and they still are. And, you know, they do amazing, amazing things. And for somebody, it's like, you know, who's worked his way up and has gone to the levels of success that he's achieved, it's just remarkable. It's like, you know, he still, till date, inspires me.
So you get this kind of crash course of what's going on in a restaurant. And then after that, you do end up purchasing a restaurant in Chicago, or
so
was it somewhere else?
So we both, my wife and I was fortunate. I'd say, although I worked in consulting, I didn't travel. And my wife traveled at the time. And we had our first kid, and, you know, she was older. She was going into kindergarten, and it was just getting difficult for me to try and manage a kid. And as a young dad, I was not used to it. And there was a lot of learning curve there. And so it's like, and my wife was always struggled, because, you know, she wanted to spend more time and we couldn't, but she didn't want to leave the job. So that wasn't an option. So one of the things was, like, it's like, if we move to the headquarters, and she works for Oracle, by the way, and if we move to the headquarters, then maybe she can just do something at the headquarters and we probably don't have to move. So we decided to move to California. Mm. So it was ironic, because in my career, although, you know, me and my wife, we've been together 30 years almost, and 25 of those to be married. You know, we've always, it's like, you know, studied together since undergrad, then, you know, grad school as well. And then we kind of, like, worked together. We always started off in the same company, went different ways, then came back to the same company. And here I was, it's like, you know, again, after we had separated our paths, it's like, you know, I went on to the tech side and she was still in financial. And then she joined Oracle. And then I applied at Oracle. They hired me. They moved me to California. And then she took a transfer. So we were back at Oracle.
There
both
you
of
go.
Us.
Keep coming back together.
We keep coming back together.
So you were working at that time for Oracle on the tech side.
On the tech side. So,
can you dive into that a little bit? What exactly does that mean? You were doing tech consulting.
So we're doing tech consulting. So it's like, I came from the banking side. So I was in their treasuries and cash management division. So which is basically, it's like, you know, when they want to develop a product to say, it's like, okay, you know, we want to do bank reconciliations. We want to do, you know, check balancing and things like that. It's like, what are the things and the systems? And it's like, you know, what is the information that's needed? Because the coders are not going to know how the business actually works in a real business environment. You know, you tell them the requirements to say, oh, we want the system to be able to do this. Learning that requirement, then you translate that, and then you learn from there. It's like, you know, what data can go inside, what data cannot go inside, what structure, it's like how the reporting is going to work, you know, what flexibility you need to build in into the software, because everybody wants to see different information and those kind of things. So I brought in the functional side of the business, working in that division, and you know, that was my role.
How much of your success in the restaurants do you attribute to what you've learned practically on the job from Oracle and your other consulting jobs, how much of a transfer is there between what you and your wife do in your quote-unquote traditional jobs and what happens at the restaurant? Because no matter how good the food is, it's right. a business, right?
It is absolutely
bills come
business.
In. Bills come checks in. Checks have to go out.
They do.
You know, there's a there's a transfer,
there is a transfer
of data that occurs that seems like it's applicable.
I think it's like, you know, working in a corporate environment, what you get to learn is, you know, working with different facets of people. You know, learning to manage expectations and things like that. I don't think it's really directly replicable or transferable to what I do currently. I think education has more to do with that. Your ability to read, write, understand, decipher, and then learn, you know, from your mistakes and your successes at the same time, to be able to follow, to look up to somebody, has more to do with that. You know, when I opened up a restaurant, the only thing it's like I knew was I was one of those 8 out of 10 people that wanted to be restaurateurs. and knew nothing about the restaurant. Besides that, it's like, well, I can eat and I can probably run a restaurant as well.
Okay, perfect. You've led me to my next question, which is, you got the itch, right?
People
get this feeling that they can, they want to open up a restaurant, but you can have the means, you can have the connections, you can have the chef, but people rarely do it. It's risky. It requires a huge amount of effort. So what made you truly feel like you were ready to open up Saffron?
Well, I don't think it's like I was really ready, which you find out later after you open up a restaurant. And I was ready, but the only thing I was ready for was to open a restaurant. And, you know, I had that itch that it's like, hey, I want to do a restaurant. And it wasn't because I could do it well. It's because I just saw it as, it's like, well, this is not the food that we grew up with. And this is not the food, what we call it. It's like, you know, Indian. And it's just a very standard, you know, in my conversations, I usually tell people it's like a textbook scenario where it's like a Social Security benefits roster that you go to every Indian restaurant. They all have to have the chicken tikka masala. They all have to have the tandoori chicken and the naan. And then you can go from one restaurant to the 100th and they all have it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And nobody deviates from that. And some of it is market pressure. Others is because they don't know anything. And monkey see, monkey do is what happens, which is basically people, I think 90% of the people, 95% of the people look at the other guy's menu, at least in the Indian food industry, and then say, it's like, I'm going to open up a restaurant. Well, they almost have a similar menu. Now, if they happen to be somewhere within your vicinity of where you operate, then they either go higher or lower than you, and that's their extent of business, you know, practices or experience. And that's how they start.
So tell the listeners a little bit about Saffron. You know, you just touched essentially on, which is sort of the Americanized generalization of Indian food, which is that when people go to an Indian restaurant, they often have, they're often looking for something that's going to be fairly inexpensive.
Correct.
And they're looking for what you just said. They're looking for, you know, a vindaloo, and they're looking for a chicken tiki masala.
Absolutely.
How did you tackle that problem?
I don't think we tackled that problem. It's an ongoing struggle, which is, it's like, you know, the perception of food. And as we learn and as we evolve, as we grow, it gives us confidence every day to change the status quo, which is what we did with Rasa. When I opened up Saffron, it's like, you know, we did the dishes, we made the dishes, but it's like, you know, and food is not about being authentic or being in a certain way. It is how you feel. And it's different for everyone. You and I can both make coffee and they'll be different. At the end of the day, it's still coffee. Which one is right? I don't know. You like yours, I like mine. And, you know, that's how it is with the food as well. So it's like, you know, when we went out to eat Indian food, we didn't like it. Because, again, it's like, you know, our palate, we can relate to what we grew up eating. So it's very subjective because it's like, you know, it was probably down, you know, guy down the street from where I lived. A particular restaurant I ate at, and it's like, you know, there was so it was a reflection. So Saffron is a reflection of my memories of those restaurants and all of those dishes, which is reflective there. Some of them were, it's like, you know, cooked at our home. You know, some were obviously consumed in a commercial environment. It's like, you know, going into the fine dining restaurants to hole in the wall places, and that's what I wanted to do. And I wanted to bring in and then share that kind of food because it's like, you know, I didn't see the other one. It was still food, Indian food, but I didn't see it as that it's like, you know, this is not how it needs to be done.
How does that development process take place? You know, you can say, I want to bring those flavors from my childhood. I want my version of authenticity, right. But then you got to cook it. So were you developing recipes? Did you find a chef that sort of shared your vision? How did you create the path of the flavors and the menu so that it would reflect what you wanted it to reflect about your style?
I think the biggest thing was that I don't think it's like I could say with confidence that I could cook earlier. And over the years, give it on-the-job training, and I learned to cook. And some of it was not by choice because, you know, we lost chefs and things like that and second other things. In terms of development of any particular recipe, I think it was a combination effort, which is, you know, we try things on our own to replicate the taste of a certain thing. Then, you know, now we have the privilege of saying it's like, okay, you know, the chefs, it's like, I want a certain thing a certain way. Then I will tweak it based on it's like, you know, where my preference is going to lead me to it. To say it's like, you know, we need more salt on this one, or it's like more tomato on another one, or in, you know, some other prominent spice, it's like, you know, or a different technique. So now I guide that process, but it's like I have somebody doing it. Prior, I was doing it myself.
So do you actually, so before new dishes come on the menu still at your restaurants,
right,
do you sit down with the chef and your wife and do you do a tasting, or is it just you and sitting there and you taste and give notes? I'm curious, like, what is the actual process? Because you're not the actual chef in the kitchen, but you are the creative leader of the restaurant.
I am. I think that's probably a right justification. So today it's like what I do is it's like I give them a list of ingredients. It's, you know, like mise en place. It's like, you know, what we need to prepare. And I give them a heads up. It's like, okay, this is what we're trying to achieve and this is what we're going to prepare. But it's like, I need X, Y, and Z prepped before I come over so that we're going to play with it. And then, you know, I play there. I stand there within the kitchens and it's like, you know, I'll get hands on. It's like, you know, along with the chefs as well. And then I'll cook. They will cook. And then we'll compare. And nine out of 10 times they win because practice, you know, makes, you know, everybody perfect. And, but usually it's like, you know, I have, it's like, you know, probably a better approach to getting to where we need, you know, where we need to get to. And that's what happens. And so it's a joint effort, but generally it's like, you know, like you stated, it's like the creativity or the desire to change things come from my side.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more here on Heritage Radio.
Hi, I'm Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network. We all know and love Chinese takeout dishes like General Tso's chicken and egg rolls, but here's the thing. Even though we call it Chinese food, it's not like the food you'd find in China. What's the story behind this cuisine, and how did it become so popular that you can find a Chinese-American restaurant in nearly every town in the country? The answers may surprise you. Visit the Museum of Food and Drink in Brooklyn and see our newest exhibition, Chow, Making the Chinese-American Restaurant. Chow engages visitors with compelling accounts of how Chinese immigrants overcame racism and created Chinese-American cuisine. Discover the science behind the flavors of your favorite takeout dishes, feast on rotating tastings developed by the country's most talented Chinese-American chefs, and try your hand at writing your own fortune, which will be baked into actual cookies by a 1,500-pound fortune cooking machine. What better way to learn, connect, and eat? You can visit Chow at the Museum of Food and Drink on Fridays through Sundays from noon to 6. Tickets and more information can be found at mofad.org.
Hey, like what you hear? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. With fresh programming every week, we've got something for everyone. Trying to start your own food business? Concerned about where your food comes from? Looking for the best wine or beer to bring to a party? Find our shows on iTunes or Stitcher, or head to heritageradionetwork.org to listen live and subscribe to our newsletter.
All We're back on the line on Heritage Radio. Joining me today is Ajay Walia. He is the owner of two Indian restaurants in San Francisco, Saffron and Rasa. And we were just talking about the way that he works with his chefs in the kitchen to collaborate on new dishes, which sounds like an awesome experience to me. It sounds very collaborative and it sounds fun. Coming from the perspective of someone who is a business owner and also is in the kitchen a lot, I'm curious about how you find your staff. How did you find the chefs that lead your restaurant? And what is the process like of integrating them into this kind of collaborative environment where you say, like, I really want your guys' input, but also I do have some constraints before you start cooking. I have some ideas of my own that I'd like to introduce.
So I think it's like, you know, it's just, you know, for the most part, it's like, it's just about like every other business. Most of it is networking, which is basically, it's like, you know, I work there. I like the work environment. It's like, oh, I know somebody else who's looking for a job as well. And then it's like, you know, that's how the team gets built. We're fortunate enough. We don't have a whole lot of turnover. And in 15 years, it's like we've not had that many. And that's one of the reasons behind our success as well, because things stay consistent. Either they're consistently bad and they become the norm, or they're consistently good and they become the norm. But they're consistent. I think that's the key word. And, you know, so it's like, so this is how we usually find our staff. It's like, you know, through references. And everybody who comes on board, it's just my philosophy that it's like it's a very collaborative, team-oriented environment. And we need to take everybody's input. We do need to consult everyone because there needs to be a buy-in from everyone. Because if you're not invested into the process, how do you enforce it? And it's something that I have naturally always operated with. It's not something that I have developed. And it's a collaborative environment. It's like, you know, we always ask the chefs, it's like, okay, you know, how about you create your version of it, then I will create my version of it, and we'll see whoever wins. Sometimes I win, sometimes they win, right? And sometimes we all lose because, you know, while in theory it sounded excellent, but on a production line it doesn't make any sense, you know, so that's as well.
From a business perspective, so I have a restaurant that I run with my brother. It's fairly new, but we had to get investors in order to open. And part of the process of going through that is writing a pro forma and sort of developing this elevator pitch of explaining what the restaurant's going to be, how successful is it going to be, you know, what do we hope to achieve with it. You had a wonderful business background. You had obviously been in many professional settings.
Yes.
I'm curious, without having, you don't have to go into, you know, extreme detail, but did you self-fund the restaurant? If not, if you had investors, can you explain what either one of those processes was like, either trying to raise funds or what it was like going alone, if that's the route that you took?
Well, you know, initially, it's like, and it was going alone, and it still is the case for the most part. And, it's very difficult because it's like it's hard to explain to someone. It's like, you know, when I started, you know, we went to the banks and the bank said, it's like, well, you have zero experience. We can't lend anything to you. So if you're so hell-bent upon it, it's like doing it, it's like, why don't you put your skin in the game?
Right.
And that's what we ended up doing. And it's like, you know, we put the skin in the game and every piece of clothing that we own along with it. You know, so not only that, it was all in or all out.
And so when you sit down with your wife and you are deciding together that you want to do a restaurant, is the initial feeling that it would be sort of all encompassing, or did you both necessarily view it as potentially a wonderful side project? And I'm curious, at what point did it fully overtake your life? Had you left your job at Oracle when you decided to start doing the restaurant, or were you doing both simultaneously?
So I think for a very brief moment, probably maybe about a period of 4 months, or actually less than that, it's like I was doing a combination of both. And at the time I was working at Cisco, after I left Oracle, and I had bought this pizza place. Mm-hmm. And which we were going to turn into an Indian restaurant. And then it's like I met some coworkers at at the place, and they always said, it's like, oh, I used to go there as a child because it was a pizza place from 1962. I'm a sucker for nostalgia. Uh-huh. And not knowing anything, it's like, you know, it's like emotional decisions rather than financial decisions. I was like, it's like, okay, we're going to keep it the pizza restaurant. Because how many places can you go to where you can say, it's like, I came here when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was very happy with my decision because it wasn't really a huge money maker, but it made me happy. And I met people there that came with their grandkids now. And they said, it's like, you know, I proposed to my wife on sitting on that table over there.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to make those memories disappear once disappear. You hear the stories.
When you hear that, so it's like, so the more you hear, the more difficult it gets. But eventually, it's like, and as I in a couple of months right after, it's like I bought that pizza place. It's like we started Saffron. And I dove more into it, and then my focus was divided between the two places. But it's like, you know, pizza didn't come naturally to me. Indian food did. And although it's like the pizza place did well, it's like, you know, eventually it just faded away. Mm-hmm. And I kept it open just because it provided employment for the people that worked. And I inherited the employees at that location. I owned that location for about 10 years. And they were pretty much the same employees the all 10 years. And we still have, it's like, employees at Saffron. It's like we've been there 14 plus years. Mm-hmm. And that's because it's like, you know, initially, first we couldn't afford employees, so we were doing a whole lot by ourselves. And then slowly the ones that we could afford have stuck around. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, so that's where we are.
Tell me about Rasa. How did Rasa come to be? How many years after Saffron did you open it? And when you set out to open it, how different did you either want it to be, or did you hope that it would be different from Saffron?
Well, definitely the intent was that the next project was going to be different from my last project, because I am not a big proponent of, you know, duplicating whatever I do, because there's no challenge in it. It's, you know, you just don't go from Saffron 1 to 2 and 3 and 4. It's just, I mean, for some people, it's a successful route. It's not something that I aspire to do. And when we set out, it's like it was 10 years after I'd been in business that I finally got the courage of saying, it's like, okay, yes, I can open up another restaurant. And more than the courage, I think it was pushing by my wife. Mm-hmm. That I think you're ready because you just stay home a little too much now.
10 years is long enough. One, let's try number two.
And so it's like, you know, so we came up with the concept of it wasn't going to be Rasa. It was going to be a different restaurant. And, we, you know, we hired a chef from India. It's like we, you know, did his visa and everything else. And it's like we brought him over. We signed up a lease for a restaurant. And that lease didn't pan out because it's like I got a call from one of my guests who was a regular, and she indicated it's like, you know, that the location that we were looking at, and it was all negotiated, you know, 5 months into going back and forth with attorneys, that it's like the biggest chunk of the business which we were counting on was lunch business, and her company was right across the building that they were leaving, moving to another location. Mm-hmm. So that entire weekend was a dilemma of whether do we want that location or not. And we decided, it's like, you know, that we're not going to do that location. And we pulled out come Monday. Friday, get this call. Monday, it's like we make a decision. It's like, okay, we're not going to go ahead with it. Mm-hmm. And so we waited about a month. And then the current Rasa location came up onto the market. It had been a restaurant for 30 years. And 8 of those years have been that it was a previous Indian restaurant as well. And long story short, it's like, you know, we decided, it's like, okay, we're going to take this new concept that we wanted to develop in this other location. We're going to take it to where Rasa is today. And we started, it's like, you know, we very enthusiastically signed up and everything else. And it's like we started with the process and then ran into building roadblocks. The classic rookie mistake. You know, you plan on, it's like, well, 90 days, we'll be ready because we're so optimistic. And it took us about 18 months. And as I went along in the process, and about maybe about a 1 year mark, I got so disenchanted with it that it was like, it's like, to hell with this. It's like, I'm not going to even open. It'll remain the way it is. I'll continue to pay rent till we can figure it out what we're going to do. And, you know, that's how it's going to be. And then one fine morning, it's like on the New Year's Day, I woke up with this newfound energy to say, it's like, you know what? We're not even going to do that project that we're going to do. We're going to do South Indian. Now, and Rasa was born.
So for the listeners that are not clear on what South Indian is, can you explain a little bit about some of the flavors, some of the menu items that are on Rasa that differentiate it from perhaps not only Saffron, but from other restaurants that they may be familiar with?
Okay. Well, I mean, so most of us are only familiar with Indian cuisine, not the nuances of the cuisine. Mm-hmm. But it is a big country. It does have a lot of variety. We have east, west, north, and south, just like every place else. And southern Indian cuisine is reflective of, you know, starting going down towards the coastal cuisine and then coming up towards West Bengal. And on that peninsula, so the clearest or the cleanest definition is it's like northern food we define as little to be more richer, more heavier, more, I would say it's like grain-based, more cream-based. Southern Indian food happens to be more rice-based, lentil-based. And then, of course, it's the abundance of the ingredients within the area. So it's a lot of coconut, a lot of tamarind, so a lot of cooling spices. But it's also coming in from a region which is much harder than the north, and which by the virtue of being the geographic location makes the cuisine a tad bit spicier than the northern food. So northern food is not as spicy as the southern food is. And when I say spice, it's like I don't mean heat necessarily. It's more, more prominent flavors of, the spices. You taste them a lot more.
So a greater intensity of the spices used sometimes.
Correct, because it's like, if you look at the northern Indian food, it's like at least here, there's a lot of butter and cream, mm-hmm. which kind of like dulls down or mutes.
It can mute the flavors.
It can mute the flavors a little bit, but it's like it's not so much in the southern Indian food.
So Rasa is, it's a Michelin-starred restaurant.
It is.
And was that an intention upon opening to try to court that type of accolade, or did it come out of the blue?
It came out of the blue. It was a shocker, in fact. Mm-hmm. And, it was never the intent that we wanted to run a Michelin star restaurant. Now it's more than running the restaurant is managing expectations. And we just wanted to present a food in a very different way. We wanted people to experience what Southern Indian cuisine is, the nuances. And there are tons of Southern Indian restaurants, across the United States. One of the primary things is, I would say, majority of them are vegetarian restaurants. And we didn't want to be one because it's not like people in the South don't eat meat. And so we wanted to present that as well, that it's like we wanted to be all-encompassing, a better, fuller menu, which is a representation of every kind, a bounty of Southern Indian food. And we wanted to present that. And that's how it's like, we structured Rasa.
You mentioned the word managing. You said managing expectations. Yes. And the word expectations in a restaurant is so tied up in so many different things. The hospitality of the experience extends from the food to the greeting at the front door to the bathrooms. You have two restaurants. One has been open longer than the other. So you have different expectations to manage. One is you have a Michelin-starred restaurant and people have a lot of ideas tied mm-hmm. up in that. And another one has been around for even longer. And so there are expectations of longevity and people say, well, if it's been here for X amount of years, it must have this, this, and this. I'm curious, what to you are the greatest challenges at both restaurants in terms of the hospitality and the managing of expectations?
Well, I think the biggest factor, I think the most common combining element between the two is food. And, you can't run a restaurant, be it Michelin or any other way, if the food is bad. So that's the first and the foremost focus. And at Saffron, it's like, that's always been the focus, where it's like, I think our claim to fame, or more like it's like, our survival depended upon that we always strived, and it's like, we always stood behind the quality of what we produced. And it's like, if we were ever in doubt, it's like it was just never served, and it still is true today. In terms of managing expectation, obviously, it's like, we have a little bit more leeway in Saffron than we have in Rasa. People are more forgiving there. And people are not so forgiving in Rasa because it's a Michelin-starred restaurant. And I'm not quite sure exactly how do I manage that, but somehow it's like, you know, we were the same restaurant before the accolade, and we are the same restaurant after the accolade as well. And, you know, we're in a suburban neighborhood. We're a neighborhood family restaurant. We don't have tasting menus. You know, we don't tout ourselves to be that way. But it's just managing expectations between the two.
Do you still come up against the sort of negative connotations of how Americans, you know, Caucasian Americans perceive Indian food? Have you transcended that at either of your restaurants, or is that still something that is like a day-to-day struggle?
I think it's an ongoing battle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something that has been ingrained into their brains for many years. It's like, I don't think I can change it in 10, although I've been trying.
It is interesting, though, that sort of Japanese has been able to achieve a sort of a, for lack of a better term, like a low and a high-end designation, right?
Correct.
Like, you can get $4 sushi and you can get $400 sushi.
Absolutely.
Do you ever think about like a game plan of how you fit in that sort of?
I think it's like, you know, I think things are changing.
Mm-hmm.
I think definitely things are changing. We see a lot more Indian restaurants that are trying to break the norms. It's like, you know, we're definitely not the first Michelin star Indian restaurant. We may be the first ones on the West Coast, but it's like, we're definitely not the first ones. We've had, UK has always had, it's like, you know, terrific Indian food. And they've always had Michelin star restaurants there as well. So it's like, so you do have, you know, dive places, you know, low end, hole in the wall places. And then you have a higher end. It's like, you know, I don't think we're quite at the 400 level mark yet, but it's like, we're making our way slowly. It's a long road. But it's getting there. And now it's like, you know, now we see a lot more people getting in. And I think it's got more to do with not so much as Indian cuisine. It's the people behind the cuisine. And there's more and more people are coming in that have better backgrounds, not necessarily the culinary backgrounds, but it's like, at least it's like the business acumen side of it, where they don't want to open up a restaurant just because it's like, you know, they want a restaurant, you know, and they're opening up a restaurant because it's like they want to present something. And, you know, they're challenging themselves. They're challenging the norms. The chefs are taking that risks as well. And all of a sudden, it's like, you know, this profession has become more glamorous than it was before.
Definitely.
Yeah.
That leads me to my next question about sort of the glamour and the changing paradigm of being involved in restaurants, which was when you were growing up, restaurants was really it was a working class profession. And like
Absolutely.
You had said earlier, it wasn't usually filled with people who had gone to finishing schools, right?
Correct.
It was a job that you could do with your hands, and if you worked hard, you could be there. Now you run restaurants, but you have an MBA, and you went the professional route. This also, I think, is tied up in a lot of ideas about this country and immigration and what this country can provide, which is a platform to be successful.
Absolutely.
I know that you closed your restaurant on February 16th.
Yeah.
And I want you to first talk a little bit about, you know, how you came to that decision. And then after that, I want to ask you about another question related to how coming to this country and coming here with what we would consider sort of like a traditional career trajectory, how you feel about now sort of changing with times, and now you're a restaurateur, which wasn't glamorous, you know, 20,
yes,
30 years ago when you came here.
Right. Well, I mean, it definitely was not glamorous. It's like, and I'll tell you from my personal experience that when I opened up the first restaurant and I shared that with my father, his verbatim response was, if you wanted to do dishes, you could have done it here. Why did you make me waste money?
That's a good line, Dad. That is a good line.
And it's like, you know, and today it's the same guy. It's like, who says, oh, my son has restaurants. And, you know, so that's changed within our family. But this country does give everybody an opportunity, and everybody has a story to tell. It's like, you know, mine is different than others. It's like, you know, and everybody has a different one to say. But here the recognition is there for the labor, which is not necessarily there. It's like, you know, in some other countries as well. So it's like, so there is a dignity in labor, which is recognized here. If you can work hard, you can succeed. And I think it's like, it gives you the confidence, people, the positivity. That's there. It's like, you know, the other people's encouraging. It's like, well, great. It's like, we're happy for you. It's like, that doesn't exist in so many other places. You will always have people that are negative about it and everything. Oh, it's like, this guy opened up a restaurant right next to me. I hope he fails. You know, that will always be there, but it's like, I don't think it's healthy, but it's like, I think majority of it is positive. And that's what's so unique about this country, that you can come in and most people, it's like, you know, have a story to tell. Somebody came with two bags, others came with none. You know, some came with, it's like $10 in their pocket, another came with $1,000, but that's pretty much it. It's like nobody brought a home over here. Mm-hmm. Nobody brought a huge bank account for the most part. And people have had remarkable successes in this country. And that's what the whole entire immigrant experience is. And there's not even, it is a country of immigrants, made up by immigrants. Nobody was born here. You're born as you go along, but it's like everybody migrated at some point in time. So, you know, so that's how I feel.
What does the next 10 years bring for both of your restaurants? Do you have plans? Do you have ideas that you can share, or are you just kind of a day by day type of person and wait and see?
I think we all make plans here and there, but when it comes to restaurants, we're in a business which is a day by day business and an opinion by opinion business. Every time of the day, right? Every operating hour of the day. If you had 100 people dine in with you, it's like, well, you almost were subjected to 100 plus opinions that particular day. So it's hard to like project, you know, 5 years down the road. What you could project is, it's like, you know, I think is where your goals are as to how and where you want to sustain. And then it's like, you know, reading into those numbers, looking into those trends, and then seeing, it's like, you know, how do you achieve growth, but manageable growth. It's like, you know, not the unrealistic Wall Street growth that year over year, we got to have 25% growth, organic growth. It's like, how do you do that? Well, number manipulation. That's it. You know, and in the real world, it doesn't happen. And you know, that's to answer your question, it's like, you know, I don't think it's like I have a 5 year plan. I think I have a 5 day plan, which is, it's like, well, next 5 days, this is what you need to do. And, you know, we want to get to certain places in a given amount of time, but there's so many challenges in your day to day. I don't think you ever get to it. So it's like, it always resets to that 5 day plan.
Tell the listeners, when they're on the West Coast or if they're in the San Francisco area, where can they find both of your restaurants? Just give it addresses of both.
Well, Rasa is located south of the San Francisco International Airport in downtown Burlingame at 209 Park Road. You can certainly look that up at rasaindian.com. And Saffron is located farther down south, about 7 miles from the San Francisco International Airport, in the lovely downtown of San Carlos on 1143 San Carlos Avenue in San Carlos. And it's saffronindianbistro.com.
Thank you so much for being here and sharing your story with us. Please join us next week, Tuesdays at 11 a.m. for the new episode of The Line here on Heritage Radio.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.